From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. The federal government is asking states for voter information, and in some cases, state election officials are pushing back. We'll hear how Idaho's top election official, Secretary of State Phil McGrain, is handling the situation. Actress Michelle Azar is bringing her one-woman show about the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Spokane. Kirsten Weber talks with her about that. Spokane poet laureate Mary Noelle Smith talks poetry with us, hers, and the others whose work she promotes. And we'll go back to an Inland Journal from late 2024 to remember jazz clarinetist Ken Peplowski, who recently passed. Peplowski came to Spokane to play with local groups. Join us today for Inland Journal. Idaho Secretary of State Phil McGrain recently wrote a column with a provocative title, "Civility is not weakness, it's leadership." That didn't surprise me. If you watch McGrain interact with legislators and others, you see he's a pretty even-keeled guy. But even even-keeled guys can get ticked. There's an interesting backstory here. McGrain was responding to an Idaho Statesman editorial that suggests he's too nice, especially in his dealing with federal election officials who are looking for information about voters.
It wasn't the first time that Scott McIntosh, the editor who wrote it, and I have kind of bumped into each other about him wanting me to be more aggressive, I guess, in some sense. But you probably saw from my response, I didn't take kindly to the inference that I'm too nice. And more importantly, the idea that politics, I think, I will say for myself, but I think there's plenty of Americans who are kind of tired of the vitriol and the shouting that is happening in all political stripes. And so the idea that the Attorney General and I were going to go on the Capitol steps and tell the Department of Justice to, quote unquote, pound sand is so ridiculous. But more importantly, like I feel like I'm very effective at what I do. I just do it in my way, and I do it behind the scenes. And there's still a lot of merit to civility and statesmanship.
Have you had those kinds of conversations with the Department of Justice yet?
I have had ongoing conversations with the Department of Justice, yes.
And people are saying that, well, I guess they would ask, what have you told them?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting, overwhelmingly, I think the perception is I've stood the ground for Idaho. And we've provided our public data, but we haven't provided any of our personal identifying information to the Department of Justice. They know that. We know that. The Idaho Statesman knew that. And so I think I'm doing exactly what my constituents want, but I don't have to do it in a way that was described by the Idaho Statesman.
Your Secretary of State colleague in Washington, Steve Hobbs, has been a little more vocal about it, and Washington has been sued. Has the Department of Justice threatened Idaho if it didn't get everything that it wanted?
We've certainly been threatened. We have not been sued yet. And I think one of the important things in this space too often, and Secretary Hobbs and I know each other well, if you're a Democratic secretary with the Trump administration, it's in your best interest politically to tell him to go jump in the Puget Sound. That is not the same for the Republican secretaries navigating it. And obviously, we have some Republican states that have given the data right away, but lots of Republicans struggling with the same challenges the Democrats are. And not to make this all partisan, but it's hard in this environment not to see those layers. And so just trying to navigate, and the roles could be reversed if it was a different administration, right? I think there's too many points in politics these days just on partisanship. And so part of it is trying to really be thorough and maintain not just there's the politics piece, but more of the integrity of just elections overall. I'm a lifelong election official, and I really believe in the work that we all collectively do to make sure that the voting systems work and that voters can have confidence that their votes count. And we're going to continue to do that work. And as you probably read from the Statesman, I'm going to continue to smile and be friendly as I do it. I like to think even my kicking back was somewhat civil in my own way, despite I didn't mince words on what I thought.
Yeah. Well, not to be too glib about it, but does it help that Idaho has been a pretty strong ally to the president?
In terms of
maybe the state of Idaho not being sued yet for not turning over all the information that the Department of Justice wanted?
I don't think so. No. If you independently go to check out Harmeet Dillon's Twitter feed, she's, I think, harder on the Republican states than she's even on the Democratic states.
Okay. Looking back over the last 5 to 10 years, how do you characterize kind of the rhetoric that is coming from not only, you know, the state of Idaho, but the legislature? It's been pretty rough over the last several years.
I don't think it's anything unique to Idaho. I think it's indicative of the country, just where we are. I was talking to a friend following the state of the state and kind of the shouting exchange between some of the members of Congress and the president. And someone commented, like, well, that is actually a pretty accurate reflection of the state of the union.
Do you get chided sometimes by legislators who are wishing that you had sharper elbows or at least showed sharper elbows?
Scott McIntosh probably expressed it the most, but I actually think I have a pretty good reputation. I mean, if you watch the Idaho legislature well enough, and I don't think I'm out of turn sharing this, but I was talking to Josh Tanner the other day. We had an issue we were working on, and we were talking about somebody who I don't get along with well in this building. And he's like, I don't get it. He's like, everyone gets along with you. How could you not like get along with just, and that's part of my reputation is, you know, I'm the bald guy with glasses wandering around the building. But I think in doing so, I'm really effective. I think the voters have seen that, you know, elections has been a hot topic, but our office has taken a leading role. And I think I've built the rapport and credibility with the legislature, right? And really across political stripes on that front. And so I'm going to keep, it's working for me well. You know, if you look at Brandon Wolf or there's others who operate very similar to how I do. One of the coolest things, obviously, the Statesman piece got a pretty strong reaction. I didn't care for being called spineless, but the response initially just started as my cathartic effort to get it, you know, my feelings out of my system. But what was amazing is the reach, just like the fact that you've reached out, the breadth of people who've reached out to me or seen it that I never would have imagined has been really cool.
Phil McGrane is the Republican Secretary of State in Idaho. He's the state's top elections official. Last week, he announced he's running for a second term. All things equal, the life and trials of Ruth Bader Ginsburg is an intimate portrait of the groundbreaking U.S. Supreme Court justice. The one-woman play debuts in Spokane Saturday at the First Interstate Center for the Arts. Actress Michelle Azar portrays Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Kirsten Weber talked with her.
Tell me about the connections between her life and yours.
The first scene that I read, I remember just so vividly when she said, "My mother was the first in her family to be born in this country." So I'm from an Israeli-American family. My father is Israeli. My mother is born in America, but her mother was born in Poland. So I've been deeply aware of being a first-generation Jewish woman living in a country that was not my family's origin. Ruth talks about her mother having graduated high school at 15, and so did both my mother and her mother was 12 when she came to this country and lost her mother on the boats to Ellis Island and was put into the sweatshops in New York City. She says, my mother would have gone to college, but it wasn't like that at the time. Instead, she went to the sweatshops and she was expected to turn over part of her weekly salary to pay for her oldest brother's college education. And all this longing for education. And so Ruth talks about when her mother died of cancer when Ruth was just in high school, they found out afterwards that her mother had secretly managed to save $8,000 of her own money just so that Ruth could get a college experience, everything that her mother had longed for. You know, we finished this beginning part of the play saying it's just one generation, just one, between that and a woman being on the Supreme Court of the United States. Is mind-boggling. And that's how I feel when I think about my father's mother being 12 years old when she was arranged into marriage and started having babies at, you know, 14 years old. And I look at my 25 and 21-year-old daughters who are out there in the world and creating change through art and how I'm just this conduit.
What is it like representing someone who is so significant in our very recent history?
It's enormously humbling. I have to watch myself all the time from getting overly sensitive. I feel lucky that I'm put to the test often. So people ask me, why didn't she step down? They're so angry at her. Why didn't she fight for it this way? And why did she fold this way? And I feel like I can take the cues from her to say what it's like for me is it's a great lesson constantly for all of us to stay calm and listen to the real question at hand, which is one of pain, which is one of how can we continue to believe and hope for a better future? So she said, fight for the things you care about, but fight in a way that make other people listen. If you look at her relationship with Justice Scalia, may he rest in peace, she said, we were the odd couple of Washington, D.C., but we understood how to stay dignified with each other, how to listen to each other. In fact, she credits him with making her writing more cohesive, more coherent. They knew that they could be opposed in their ideology, but it was deeply important not only for them, but for the entire country that they stay in the listening. And I really also believe that what our show is doing is reminding each and every single person that comes that everybody can be a conduit for change and change for the good. Not that everybody has to believe the same thing.
What is the range of audience reactions? I would imagine that you've got a lot of audiences that are just thrilled and embracing this. Are there audience reactions at the other end of the spectrum?
I always think about that first month when we were incubating this beautiful play. You know, the title is The Life and Trials of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So we're not trying to dupe anybody, but people would come and sit in that theater for a good 60 minutes. And then as soon as in the last half of the show, I start talking about Trump or I start talking about abortion, and people get up in a huff and leave, or did. Now we're in these very big theaters most of the time. So if people are leaving, I don't see it or feel it quite as much. But I wanted to say in those moments, darling, please just take a moment and sit down. We'll talk about it in 20 minutes after the play, meet me in the audience. Some nights feel like a pep rally. Anything, people are on their feet applauding. The show takes an extra half hour because there is such joy. And then some nights are definitely quieter, more measured. And I remind myself that it's not a reflection of whether or not the show is good or bad. It's what the audience really needs to hear.
When you've spoken to audience members to hang in there and I'll talk with you afterwards, have you done that?
Oh, yeah. Especially like when there's a child in the front and they really knowledgeable. I just can't get over it. How many great people out there are teaching their kids who this woman was. Oh, yeah. I bring them backstage. I show them all the costumes. We talk about their trajectory, what they're interested in. Or sometimes I come out to the front and I meet people that are really crying. They really just miss her and feel so unseen by the administration. I can't fix it, but I just try to hold space for them and try to answer their feeling state, not so much their questions. But when they do have questions, I remind them of she was trying to stay on the court to keep the dignity of the court. The other thing that helps when I talk to people is it reminds them that we are better off than we used to be.
For the audience members coming in, what do you hope that they bring to the theater with them?
After doing the show in Sag Harbor, a man came up to me afterwards. He said, I am so glad I came. I was so angry at her while she was fighting for women's rights. I really didn't understand. I was so angry at her that she stayed on the court. But I came tonight because my wife really wanted me to come. I am so glad I came. It answered a lot of questions, and I have such deep respect for her. I hold that one with me. I hope people can come who don't think that they need to be there. I hope people can come who feel unseen currently in this climate on any level. I hope people can come and stay just listening to the story of a human who saw her ability to read and write as a conduit for equality. If there's something that we see might be unfair, uncaring, or unequal, that there are words that we have every right to say. I dissent, and maybe on a smaller scale, and maybe with sweeter, calmer, more compassionate, hopeful ways. It doesn't have to be through aggression. That's what I want people to come to hear and to talk about anew, that we can see each other without aggression and to slow down and build our endurance for the spots that we don't agree.
All Things Equal, The Life and Trials of Ruth Bader Ginsburg is this Saturday, March 7th at 7:30 p.m. More information is available at firstinterstatecenter.org. I'm Kirsten Weber reporting.
Mary Noelle Smith has begun her third year as Spokane's Poet Laureate. She is the bard of the Spokane poetry scene.
A lot of Poet Laureate for me has been just a service position of trying to raise awareness and advocate for the arts in places and for people who don't necessarily have equitable access to art and community, especially poetry, because it's been a little bit of like an elitist sort of boutique kind of feeling. It's like a cool little boutique downtown that only certain people were going to. And now I think that's been changing for, you know, before my term, but I certainly have been making a dent in it since I got here.
So has being Poet Laureate changed the way you approach your own poetry or write or create since you've been exposed to so many more people in this position?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think every poet would like to go back to any of their older poems and be like, I want to edit that. I want to edit that. I want to edit this, you know, this interview. There will be things where I'm like, that's not quite what I meant. That wasn't quite the right word. So it's definitely informed me in the fact of like just having some influence from other experiences that I hadn't had prior to this. The amount of people and places that I've gotten to travel to. And I did a show in Ketchikan, Alaska on the radio there, which was lovely, about poetry with my niece. So it's afforded me these awesome experiences. And I think just the craft of poetry itself has been probably enhanced because I've been, you know, fortunate to be a part of Fish Trap and Lit Fuse and go to some other writing festivals and just be a student there, which is my two favorite things are being a teacher and being a student.
Later this year, Noelle Smith will take up the role as mentor to Spokane's first ever student poet laureate. Spokane Arts is taking applications this month from poets aged 14 to 17, but she'll also continue to work on her own poems. Can I ask, what form do your poems take? Are they sonnets? Are they long form? Tell me how you like to write poetry.
Vibes. It's all vibes. I'm definitely not a form girly. I'm one of those like prosy poets. I can get into long form, but most of my work is kind of like anthems. I write to sort of meet myself where I actually am. And most often when I am somewhere, I'm trying to meet that part of me that's sad or afraid or confused. And so it's usually met with like, come on, and like hope, and like, you got this. It's like, it turns into being this sort of like anthem for the truth and this anthem for what's to come and what we can hope for. But I wouldn't say that it's like I use any sort of form particularly. It's like I'll write it, and then playing with form can be like, what would serve this poem the best? And I can kind of play around with form after the fact, but usually I just write to write and then we'll pull things like form later.
And how do you know when it's done?
Oh my gosh. Everyone says you don't know when the poem is done. I think that that's probably true. I was like, before I got here, why I was late is because I was editing a poem that I had written a few weeks ago that I was so excited about. I went to Broken Mic, I shared it, I was really happy with it and thought it was so perfect. And then I opened it up today and I was looking at it and I was like, no, it's all wrong. I could see and hear things today that I couldn't see and hear even when I was doing my best to pay attention a few weeks ago. That's just how art has worked for me. And I think it works like that for a lot of people. It's just having an acceptance that maybe the poem isn't ever going to be done, but do we get it to a place that we want to share it? I'm not mad that I shared it last couple weeks ago. I'm glad that I did. I think I can make it better today, knowing what I know now, having the experience that I've had now. I think I could make it a better poem.
So a few weeks is one thing, but would you go and rewrite a poem you wrote 10 years ago? Or is that a part where you said, okay, it's finally done?
Yeah.
Statute of limitations, so to speak.
Yeah. My chapbook, Crumbs, came out in 2021. I self-published it. I made 300 copies of it and sold them over like the Inland Northwest. And I would love to go back in so many ways and edit, and because it feels like such a, you know, an amateur collection. And I'm glad I can't. I won't, because I meant what I meant when I meant it, and I said what I said when I said it, and it was true enough, and it was enough then. And I think the fact is that it will be enough, you know, moving forward. I don't need to constantly edit work.
If you had to counsel one of those 14 to 17 year old poets about how to write, what would be the top one or two things you would tell them about?
Well, I tell this to every student, whether, because I've got students, you know, as young as like grade school, first grade, second grade. I've got students at Touchmark Senior Living Center that are writing their very first poems at 104 years old. So we all do the same practice, which is write every day. Set a timer and set it for something that you can meet and reach, like set yourself up for like a slow pitch that you're just going to knock out of the park, because momentum is the biggest, I think, challenge around writing, or maybe even any art, is just the constant creating. And that kind of energy builds. And especially when you set the timer for 5 minutes and you want to go an extra minute, that feels so good. And when we do those free writes, we start every workshop I ever lead, we start with a 10-minute free write. The whole point is don't read it, because as soon as you start reading it, you're going to start judging it. And once you start judging it, you are in the way of the flow. You're not the channel, you're the obstacle in the channel. So you write just to write and let it free flow out, and you do that every day. You show up for that practice every day, no matter how you feel about it or what you think about it, and watch from there as your writing and your strength grows as a, you know, composer. Because that's really what poetry is. It's music.
That's Spokane Poet Laureate Mary Noel Smith. Spokane Arts is accepting applications for the city's new Student Poet Laureate until the end of the month. Jazz clarinetist Ken Peplowski passed away last month. He died in his cabin on a jazz cruise. He had been fighting a form of blood cancer. In November 2024, Peplowski was in Spokane to play with jazz bands here and to talk with students at Spokane Falls Community College. Local musicians David Larson and Garen Hertel brought him into our studio, where I asked him when he learned to play.
My brother got a trumpet, I got a clarinet. And I fell in love with the instrument. And then my brother and I, you know, I grew up in Garfield Heights, Ohio. And I don't know if you know this, but the law in Garfield Heights, Ohio, is if you're Polish and you play an instrument, you have to have a polka band. So that's what we did. When I was, I think, 11 and my brother was 13, we had this Polish polka band. We were playing weddings and dances, which meant we also had to play old standards. So by necessity, I picked up the saxophone, too. And the more I played, the more I thought I want to do this for a living, and started branching out as I got into junior high school and high school and played with jazz bands around town. So
I want to go back. So why did you land in the clarinet? What is it about the clarinet that speaks to you, just as your brother played the trumpet?
Yeah, well, I think it's the sound of the instrument, the feel of it. And also, once you get past the beginning years, you know, which is always difficult on every instrument. There's a thing about clarinetists, because there's not many of us. It's a small group of jazz clarinet players. It still is. So I think we take a special pride playing that instrument, because there's so many saxophonists out there. But clarinet is a very unforgiving instrument. If you put it away for a day or two, you feel it. So in saxophone, you can, dare I say, you can get a little lazy with it sometimes, you know. Even practicing, I spend most of my time on the clarinet, and the technique transfers over to the saxophone.
Are there certain instruments that the clarinet goes with better? It's kind of like a, you know, it's kind of like a recipe, you know, sometimes this ingredient goes best with this.
Yeah, well, yes, I think the clarinet fits best with more acoustic jazz, generally. The clarinet, like flute, double, some of the double reeds, oboe, it can't cut well above an electric band, above a really amplified band. It just doesn't work, which is why, actually, that's my theory as to why the clarinet kind of died out for a bit, because you can trace that the jazz music from Benny Goodman's days, Duke Ellington's days, all acoustic, you know, and then in the 60s, early 70s, Miles Davis and lots of other people went electric. Their music got really loud, and you see the clarinet drifting away. Now it's coming back again as more people are playing acoustic jazz.
So is a clarinet kind of a swing instrument that people just like to dance to it?
Or well, it started out that way, yes. But as far as I'm concerned, you could play anything on it. I've recorded everything from traditional jazz songs to John Coltrane songs on the clarinet. For me, the clarinet and the tenor saxophone are two voices. And if I'm, for example, if I'm choosing songs for a set, I hear a specific instrument for that song. So just like I would say, you know, let's get this singer for this, let's get this singer for this. That's my two voices.
So, Ken, I know that a lot of classical composers they'll have multiple gigs, you know, they'll work in Spokane, they'll work in Scotland, they'll work in Maine or something like that. It sounds like you have that same sort of thing where you've got two or three main things that you do all around the year and you fill in with stuff like this.
Absolutely. If I count up the days, I would probably spend half the year on the road. And it's a combination of, I do some gigs where I can take a quartet out, but I actually like the challenge of playing with other people, too, with other bands. You know, in the old days, when I first kind of started out my professional career, if you hit the big cities, you could find great musicians. But if you got to smaller places, not so much. But those days have changed. There's good players pretty much everywhere now. And a lot of musicians are teaching, too. And a lot of the schools want musicians that can really play well if they're going to teach jazz. And David, you know, is a great educator, too. So that's it to my advantage, because I know if I go almost any place now, I can find at least one good rhythm section to play with, a lot of times more than that. So and when the experience is good, I always want to come back, you know. So this was a great experience with both of these guys.
That was the late jazz clarinet player Ken Peplowski talking with Inland Journal in November 2024. Also in the studio with us were Spokane jazz musicians David Larson and Garen Hertel. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced by SBR News. Our radio gig is on Thursdays at 12:30 and Saturdays at 2:30. Our online version is available 24/7 at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Our daily podcast, SBR News Today, hosted by Owen Henderson, is there too. We'll return next week with a new Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik.